As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens by TheAthletic.com. I am Marc-Antoine Godin with Arpin Basu on this Monday, March 13th, a few hours before the tilt between the Canadiens and the Colorado Avalanche. Hello, my friend.
Hello, hello, hello. So, yeah, let's get this going because it is a game day. It's kind of weird recording on a game day. But the stuff we want to talk about today doesn't really have a whole lot to do with the game. Might actually turn out to have something to do with the game. We'll see. But we did want to discuss just the contrast, I think, in some respects. You know, the Canadiens are on technically, not technically. The NHL doesn't consider this a losing streak, but they have lost their last six games, even though they picked up some points along the way.
A winless streak.
I call it a losing streak. They call it a losing streak. The players refer to those games as losses, so I do too. So they've lost six in a row heading into this game against Colorado. So depending on when you're listening to it, it might be seven in a row. It might be snapped, but regardless, we covered during the final days of Dominique Ducharme some losing streaks. And it's impossible not to get the sense that this group is able to, you know, I don't want to use the word accept, but it's these losses against quality teams where they're in the game, they're competitive, have a far different feel to them. And the room itself has a far different feel from the, you know, some of the losses in the Ducharme, towards the end of the Ducharme days. So I don't know. What do you make of that? Like, it's obvious, right? I mean, and I think there's a lot of people who see the obvious parts of it, you know, the lineup, the injuries, whatever. But what's your takeaway from that difference?
I think that the biggest, it all starts with expectations, right? When you refer to Dominique Ducharme, when we think about it now, that whole era was a big black stain, at least the second, you know, the year where he was fired last season, but it started on the heels of the Canadiens reaching the Stanley Cup Finals for, you know, despite not initially being that caliber a team, it set a certain amount of expectations that they did not meet, and I think that led to massive disappointment. Whereas new management, in the way that they presented this season, in the way that they suggested that it would not be a one-year thing either. I think that it set the tone in relieving the players some of the pressure that they would be facing. There's always, they keep saying, well, the biggest pressure is the internal pressure. And I get that. It keeps them motivated and driven. And that's good. But there's also outside pressure. And that's, I think, where the contrast has been the the biggest, because the expectation towards this team being historically low, people are able to look at this team, see are they progressing, what's happening, what are the good stories, the good guys to follow, and that makes the environment a lot lighter, a lot more fun for them to work in. And when I talk about expectations, you know, in the locker room the other night, Nick Suzuki was saying, you know, I was here in a year where there were big expectations. We fell short on those expectations, and we could really feel it. We were getting it from the fans and from the media. But this year is not the case. I don't know how long this is going to be, but this to me is a very particular, very special season in that sense. And when they talk about developing the young players, well, I guess that everybody's going to benefit from having an environment where they can figure themselves out, try to get better, but without having the weight on the world of the world on their shoulders.
Yeah, and it was interesting. You know, Nick's talked about that a fair bit this year. You know, how he's even acknowledged that he's in a bit of an ideal situation to get kind of broken in as captain, in the sense that those expectations, those external expectations, are not there. So, you know, I can't think, I don't want to overly state this, but I really have trouble remembering a game this year where not only Nick Suzuki, but really any Canadiens player was really grilled about a loss, you know, was really like given the, how do you explain that? How can you explain coming out so flat for such a big game? Or how can you explain, you know, explain question after a loss? If I'm a player and I hear someone say, how do you explain X? I'm like, ah, oh, geez. You know, because some things just don't have an explanation, right? Some things it's just like, we just sucked. Like, we were just bad. But yeah. When
there are accountability questions.
The accountability questions, yeah. Like, explain yourself. Explain the team's performance. There's 20,000 people in this building that were disappointed, hundreds of thousands at home watching that are disappointed. Tell them, explain your performance, you know? And so that's when expectations are there, those are the types of questions you get after a loss, especially after a sixth straight loss. Those haven't been there because, frankly, you know, I think there's probably some of our listeners who'd be like, well, that's your job. You're supposed to ask those questions, but we would ask those questions if we got the sense that the fan base felt that way. Frankly, we get the sense that the fan base feels the opposite. They get upset when they lose, when they win. And so it's hard to kind of demand accountability from these players when their fans not only don't expect them to win, frankly, don't want them to win. So what's important is that, because there's a line there, and it's something that management had to, and mostly the coaching staff has to maintain, is that you cannot get to a place where we get the players feeling crushed. You know, the other night, on Thursday night, I wrote a piece, and it you know, I was talking to Josh Anderson. Well, a bunch of us were talking to Josh Anderson after the game. He was talking about how well they've played, how many good teams they've been facing. This was after facing the Rangers. You know, they had just faced Carolina. They had New Jersey ahead. You know, obviously Colorado on Monday. It's you know, there was a real perspective to what he was saying. And it made me think of Josh Anderson talking after what was turned out to be Dominic Ducharme's final game. It was a 7-1 loss to the Devils at home. Media was still talking to players via Zoom. And Josh Anderson got on camera and said he felt embarrassed, and looked about as down as I've seen, well, definitely him, but you know, just about any player. I mean, he looked destroyed, crushed. Yeah. Like, he was just, there was nothing positive happening in his life, professionally, and by extension, I would imagine otherwise. He looked miserable. So I asked him about that on Thursday night, and he just kind of said, well, we were getting blown out every night, you know, and this is different. You know, this, there's stuff that we're doing that allows us to compete, that allows us to stay in games, and you get the sense that you're building something solid for the future. And that's what's important. You know, that's what I think the fans who get upset over wins sometimes don't realize. And so for another little before and after exercise, we thought we'd play you two clips from the same guy. The first clip, the guy is Jake Allen. So Jake Allen spoke after the game on Saturday. Marc-Antoine was there, but also spoke back in December of 2021. And it's December 11th, actually. Now, the context for this clip is, this was Jake Allen's first game back in St. Louis. In the warm-up, there were signs in the crowd. There were people taking pictures with him. There was a real welcome back Jake Allen vibe to that game. From warm-up right to puck drop. And the Canadians came out and just laid a total egg. They lost the game 4-1. They did not look, not only did they, were they outclassed, they did not look interested in playing the game. And the only one who really did was Jake Allen. And so after the game, he looked pretty downtrodden, kind of not quite Josh Anderson in February levels, but still pretty bad. And I asked him, and this, you're going to hear his answer. I asked him, is there a danger that losing becomes acceptable or it becomes a habit? Is that a danger, and is that the kind of zone that they're entering? So here is, listen to his answer.
Yeah, you never want to get to that point. You know, I think you get to that point, that's a really dangerous avenue to go down. You know, you never want to. Losses are going to happen. Doesn't matter how good your hockey team is, but it depends on how you lose. I think, you know, how you play the game, how you respect the game, and if you lose, you lose, but you know you went it down swinging.
Okay, no, so now compare this to last Saturday, where when I asked Jake Allen that even despite the fact that some players don't like the expression moral victories, and I had the name Brendan Gallagher in mind because he hates to talk about moral victories. But I said, despite that, the Canadians have managed to remain competitive during that losing streak against top teams. And despite the outcome of those games, is there's a silver lining there that the Canadians can build on. And here's what he replied.
You have to look at it that way. If you don't, you're going to mentally grind yourself right out of this, you know, season. I think you always got to find a way to take something good out of it, you know, and I think the way we're approaching it, the way the staff's approaching it with us, you know, we want to win every game, trust me. There's a lot of fight in here. I think a lot of people are seeing that. Proud of the way the guys battle, and there's going to be a win coming sooner than later. You know, we deserve one. It's going to come on our side, but, you know, just got to keep chipping away at it. You know, it might not be next game, might be the game after. You never know when it's going to come, but that feeling is going to come back. You know, we had a lot of it at the start of the year. You know, we had a taste of it compared to last year, and I think that's, you know, what most guys are hungry to get again.
So on the one hand, you have Jake Allen talking about, sure, you're going to lose games, but it's the way you lose games. It's respecting the game. He mentioned in the first clip, yeah, respecting the game, which he didn't call out his team for not respecting the game, but he basically did. You know, I mean, basically that answer to that question, he was saying that his team was not respecting the game. And listen, if you listen to his whole availability that night, it was hard not to get that impression. And then you listen to him on Saturday night, and there's a sentiment of, it's more of a hopeful sentiment. It's not, you know, it's again, it's similar to what Josh said on Thursday. It's just like that the players are respecting the game. When he talks about, yeah, guys battling and that a win's going to come sooner or later, he's saying that because he feels his teammates are respecting the game. And that's important to hockey players. It's just something that's been fostered in this group that has an importance, even in a season where, all things being equal, management would prefer to see their team not collect too many points in the standings. Let's call it what it is. But they want it to happen a certain way. And the way it's happening right now is the way they want it to happen.
Well, that's why in our previous podcast, we mentioned it. And I think that since then, we're almost coining the term, but they're doing competitive losing. So that's good.
We got to get some t-shirts made up or something. Like it's catching on. The competitive losing thing. I mean, like, you know, you tweeted at me on Saturday, oh, this is some competitive losing. Thomas Tatar scores an empty net goal with 90 seconds left. Marty St. Louis calls a timeout and then pulls his goalie again down two goals.
Yeah.
That's competitive losing. That's sending the right message to your players, you know, that I believe in you. Let's see if we can still go get this game. They didn't, but it does send the right message. And really, I think the crux of this, that's to me, and I think you would agree, but, you know, there's a lot of things the Canadians need to find out about their players this year. And a lot of that was derailed by injury. I think they're learning a lot about Nick Suzuki in the current situation, and that's a good thing. See how he's been handling. You know, I keep thinking of the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, the meme where Will Smith's just in his house in Bel-Air and it's all empty and he's looking around for someone. I see Nick Suzuki as that guy. So how he's been handling it, I think they've learned a lot about him and how he's been sort of incorporating all the guys coming in from Laval, really acting very captain-like, you know, referring to someone who's older than him as a kid, which he does with Raphael Harvey-Pinard quite often. Yeah. But mainly, you know, even though they're not getting that information on Juraj Slafkovský or Cole Caufield and Caden Gooley missed 2 months, even a guy like Jake Evans, like there's all these guys that they would have loved to have, Arbor Jack guy. The list is too long to run the complete list. They're not getting that opportunity, but man, are they getting information on Martin St. Louis. Like, it's really, to see the team, the way their attitude, the way they compete, the way they're in games, it's really a testament to this guy and his ability to coach at this level. If there was any question, there were lots of questions before the beginning of the season. I had them, you had them, I think a lot of fans had them. I think even management had some. I think even Marty might have had some, but, well, maybe not Marty, but
he had an inner confidence that he could do it, but he was acknowledging the fact that he was a rookie and that he would need to get better at it.
Well, he's getting better at it.
No doubt about it. It's development year for the players, but for the coaching staff too.
Absolutely. And so it's we see it kind of, you know, it's just, The little improvements that players are making, the little adjustment the coaching staff is making, a lot of players have been impressed with how this staff adjusts between periods. Tiny tweaks on the breakout, on the power play, little tiny adjustments that pay off. And they're not just system adjustments. They'll go to individual players between periods and say, hey, you know when that happened? Next time that happens, why don't you try this? And they'll go out and do it and it'll work, you know? And so it's really a testament to, and I think management and the core group of players on this team can take some comfort in the fact that this rookie head coach is showing what he can do at this level right now with this lineup. The lineup, every time I tweet out the lines from the Canadians, every time I tweet out the lines, I get a barrage of replies. Like, what is this lineup? Where are you?
Yeah. HL level.
That's it. Well, so,
yeah.
Yeah.
If the that, Avalanche and then, facing and then they the Rocket.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they go out and they compete and they're in the game right till the end every time.
Okay. But let me play devil's advocate for a second, because you mentioned, you know, the, how do you explain questions and, there's another type of feedback that I get from a certain portion of the fan base, which is, why have we set the bar so low for this organization? And why is it that the Montreal Canadiens, a historical franchise who should be proud, who's been winning so many Stanley Cups, why should we be happy for a middling team that's not making the playoffs and basically satisfy ourselves with results that are that bad? Personally, that's not how I see it. Otherwise, I would have, you know, expressed myself a very different way the whole season. But it's there. And it's a discourse that we hear, because it's as though we're lowering the bar. And basically, if the expectations are so low, well, it gives an out to the Montreal Canadiens for not performing better, because anyway, the fans will be okay no matter what. You know what I mean?
Well, I would say that the Canadians have done that for a long time, refused to lower the bar, kept the standard as we expect to make the playoffs year after year after year after year, predating Marc Bergevin, but especially during Marc Bergevin's time. We expect to make the playoffs. And once you make the playoffs, you never know. That's been the mantra for over a decade. And it's produced some good moments, some great moments even. You know, I mean, 2010 run, those years of repeated matchups with the Bruins in the playoffs. Obviously, the run, the bubble, you know, the COVID run sort of in 2021. But there was nothing sustainable about it. And I think that's the one thing that Ken Hughes, the one word that he keeps using that I agree that you want to hear from a team's management group is they want to build a sustainable winner. Nothing the Canadians have done for the last, well, that's maybe a little harsh. I think they did have the basis of a sustainable winner. You know, when they had like a Pacioretty, a Subban, and a Price all entering their prime at the same time, they had kind of the foundation of a potential sustainable winner, but there was always something missing. There was always the center missing. There was always one or two pieces that weren't there and that they could never find. And so now the Canadians aren't exactly ripping it down to the studs, but they are in a way, and they've been kind of forced to in that way. I mean, you know, Weber and Price having their careers end allowed for this new management group to do what they're doing. Because let's be honest, I think Marc Bergevin probably would have looked at the situation differently had he not had those two guys. Those two guys kind of compelled him to try and keep building winners around them. And so you can't have it both ways. I mean, listen, if you're content having sort of a middling team, a team that squeaks into the playoffs every year, but has no real chance of competing. I mean, look at the Eastern Conference right now. Like, if the Canadians snuck into the playoffs this year, what would be the point of it?
Yeah. And I think that Carapace, we'll come back to the Eastern Conference in a minute, but, you know, going back to the years of Carey Price and Marc Bergevin, he was thinking, as long as I have Carey Price, we can have a decent team. We can build a big team.
And we can beat a team in the playoffs.
Exactly. It's a little bit like in Pittsburgh where they say, well, as long as we have Sidney Crosby, we'll manage to remain competitive. And sometimes it leads to questionable decisions.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Just going back to our first point, because we got a question in our voicemail this week that really, you know, that swims in those waters, let's say. About the fact that the Canadians the mood has drastically changed, is a lot more positive, and to the point where a player would rather stay Montreal instead of going to Stanley Cup contender. So let's listen to this question from a listener named Zach, who's asking us about team vibes.
My question is about the vibe of the team. You know, Joel Edmondson, forget about the injury situation, in theory had an opportunity to be traded to either a contending team or at least a team that was contending for the playoffs, and he chose to lobby publicly and probably privately not to be traded and to stay with this team that's essentially a last place team this year and probably will not be much better next year. So I wonder what it says to you about the vibe of this team that this guy who, you know, may not have too many years left would prefer to be in this situation rather than getting an opportunity to go play for a Stanley Cup again. I think it says that the energy around the team is really special. Anyways, love listening to you guys and look forward to hearing your answer. Take care.
So, yeah, Zach, you kind of nailed it. You know, that's kind of what we're talking about here. What's interesting in Edmondson's case, you know, he did actually, just to answer your question, he did lobby. When Kent Hughes pulled him aside and decided to talk to him about the trade deadline, Joel Edmondson expressed his desire to Kent Hughes to not be traded. Kent Hughes could not promise that he wouldn't trade him. And frankly, had Joel Edmondson been healthy, I am very confident that Joel Edmondson would have been traded.
No doubt.
So, you know, what's most interesting about the fact that Joel Edmondson specifically wants to stick around, wants to be a part of this, is that his shelf life, is extremely limited. Like, he is not making it past next year's trade deadline, barring injury, which is very possible in his case with the back issues he has. But if he's healthy at next year's trade deadline, if not well before that, if not this summer, I just don't see the Canadiens not trading Joel Edmondson. So he knows that. He understands that context. And yet he's sticking to this story. And I think some people would listen to Joel Edmondson speaking ahead of the deadline, speaking after the deadline, and say, oh, well, what else is he supposed to say? Well, there's a lot of things he could say. He could have said
before, say nothing.
He could choose to say nothing. He could choose to say, you know, that's out of my control. Whatever happens, happens, and I'll be happy either way. It's a business. He could say, I would embrace the opportunity to go play in the playoffs. I'm a playoff player. That's where I look my best. I would, and if it helps the Canadiens in their rebuild, then so be it. There are tons of things that he could have said other than what he actually said, which was express a sincere desire to remain with this group and try and see it through. So I think it's a great point, Zach, because him specifically saying it, I think, speaks to what we were talking about before, how the group has a sense of optimism about it when it has no reason to be optimistic. You look at the lineup. I mean, let's be honest. And let's just do this on the fly because, you know, we didn't plan on doing this. But you look at their lineup against Colorado. And how many of these forwards will be on this team next year? You know, it's not as if Rem Pitlick, doubt it. Nick Suzuki for sure. Denis Gurianov, doubt it. That's a big maybe.
Well, he's a 50 at this point. He's a 50-50, I guess.
He's a 50-50. Mike Hoffman, I honestly doubt it. If it's either by trade or by buyout, I would be surprised if Mike Hoffman was back next fall. Jonathan Drouin, no chance. Josh Anderson, 60-40, he's back in the fall. I don't know. We're gonna get to that. We'll get to that at the end. Raphael Harvey-Pinard, I'd say yes. Probably here in the fall. Chris Tierney, 50-50. I think the coach likes him. As a depth guy, I think they'd like to see him back. Jesse Ullinen. Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. Michael Pizzetta, probably. Anthony Richard, I don't think he'll be... Well, he'll be in the organization. I doubt he'll be on the team. And Alex Belzil, love him to death, but probably not on the roster. I don't know if you disagree, but...
No, I agree. I think that Tierney, Richard, and Belzil could all be with the organization, but in Laval to start the year.
So you're looking at two guys. Three if you include Harvey-Pinard. So three guys that we think have a better than 50-50 shot at being on the Canadiens come fall. Three out of 12 forwards. That's something.
We can make four if we consider Harvey-Pinard and Pizzetta, but still, I mean,
if we consider Harvey Pinard and Pinsetta, yeah, four. So that's 4 out of 12. You know, it's just it is what it's. So for Edmondson to say that, and for this whole optimism for the future to exist when this is the lineup, that's kind of the point. That's kind of what I'm saying, is that this coaching staff, and I don't want to make it all about Marty, but this because the staff too is young. It's a very young staff, and they're growing together, and they seem to enjoy each other's company, and they seem to like each other, and they seem to work well together. This is something that for the Canadiens' future, when they actually have like an NHL caliber lineup, having this coaching staff become NHL caliber, which is happening before our eyes, and I don't think it's getting quite enough attention, is a real beneficial thing for the organization and for what they're trying to do, for the sustainable winning that they're trying to create. This is part of it. This coaching staff being good is part of it.
After the team had this disastrous trip during the holidays, there was a shift in Martin St-Louis' priorities when they came back from that trip, that's when he started to talk about establishing a team culture. It was not as much a buzzword in the first half of the season, but as soon as we switched the calendar to 2023, it became really a focal point. To which, after, when you look at a lineup like that and you say, well, there's three, maybe four guys out of the 12 forwards that are playing on Monday night that, you know, that have a good chance of being on the team next year, what's really the effective what's the positive effect that you can get in creating a culture with that group if so few of those players are going to remain next year? And I'm asking the question I'll attempt to answer it myself too, but I'll let you say your bit after. But Martin St-Louis has been talking a lot about how he puts the Boston Bruins as an example of a team that has such a strong culture that whoever comes in, goes out, leaves, arrives, they integrate those people, and the train keeps going forward, right? And because the roots of the trees are so deep, et cetera. So, and I get that. I get that that's what the Canadians want to do. But that would also mean that culture needs to be developed by a lot of guys that are actually not going to be on the team next year. So it needs to have also, that culture needs to have an impact and be mindful of even the guys that are injured and are not currently playing. The culture that's being established and promoted by the guys that are on the ice now, it needs to have an effect on Cole Caulfield, who watches them practice every day. It needs to have an effect on Slafkovský, on everybody. Because otherwise, you'll need to start from scratch next year, no? Or with very little ground made.
This is what I was going to say, is that you want to know what the value is? The value for those guys you just mentioned, you can add Jake Evans, you can add Kirby Dach, you can add all sorts of guys who are watching this team play. They're not stupid. You know, they have respect for the players who are in the lineup, but they know that that's not an NHL caliber lineup. And they're watching those guys apply what Marty's telling them to do. And they're going out and they're competitive. So you want, you know, I think the other day Marty answered a question of yours and said, I don't feel like I have to sell anything to these guys right now. You know, je suis pas vendeur en ce moment. So the reason why he doesn't have to sell anything to those guys, because they're demonstrating. Well, they're bought in and they're demonstrating that what he's selling works. And so even the guys that are not in the lineup, but the guys that will be in the lineup in the fall, they're seeing it night in, night out. They're there every game, those injured guys. Just so listeners know, they're in the press box every game. It's a ridiculous sight, frankly. Like, we walk into the press box, we turn to the right to go to our seats. Immediately to the left of the entrance to the press box is the place where the injured players sit. And the press box is kind of broken up into sections that are separated by, like, you know, beams. these sections are pretty large. You know, usually like one section of the press box will be able to seat pretty much every scout that's scouting the game.
Maybe eight stools, something
yeah,
like
maybe
that.
Eight, something like that. And so, so these sections are really not big enough for all the injured players that are watching these games. You know, it's still, they're like piled on top of each other. And they'll show them sometimes on the television broadcast and you'll see them. There's a great GIF floating around of Cole Caulfield, like dancing to some beats or something, but you can see how crowded they are. But they're there. They're at the game. They're watching. So, like, to answer your question, that's the value of building a culture with these guys who won't be here necessarily, is that the guys who will be here are seeing what's happening and are seeing what the power of the coaching staff's message is, that it elevates guys, you know?
Plus, it gives an opportunity to certain guys to add some internal competition. I mean, Raphaël Hervé-Pinard, if it was not for all the injuries this year, he would not have had that chance. So, and now we established that he has more than a 50% chance of being on the team next year. Well, it's going to be at the expense of somebody else. So that's internal
competition. Frankly, I think it'd be if he does make it, it might be at the expense of Pizzetta. You know, I mean, he's like an upgrade. He doesn't do exactly the same thing as Pizzetta, but if you're looking for a fourth line energy guy with some offensive pop, maybe that's the competition next year. I don't know if that's it. I mean, I haven't really drawn up the lineup for next year yet, but when you add, you know, Slafkovsky's going to come back. Dvorak's not in right now. Doc's not in right now. Gallagher.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just like it becomes hard eventually to see, you know, who knows what's going to happen with the person they draft in the first round. I doubt they'd be compelled to bring him up, but who knows? I don't know. So we'll see. I think that's the benefit.
Okay. So now back to your other point about the Eastern Conference. And more specifically about the Atlantic Division. The thing that intrigues me is because it's been clear since the beginning that the Montreal Canadiens are not rebuilding only for one year. Otherwise, it would be labeled a retool or whatever, or rebuild on a fly. But it's clearly a process. If you want to achieve sustainable winning, it needs major surgery, and we're living that right now. But what strikes me as a challenge for management is that there are so many good teams in the Atlantic Division, and you can see right now how the Ottawa Senators are really up and coming. There's a boatload of talent in Buffalo. Even if the Florida Panthers are maybe not playing up to their potential, it's still a decent team. And the Detroit Red Wings, they fell short this year, but they're on the rise too. So there could be a day, even I feel that those teams, Ottawa, Buffalo, Detroit, are going to be good teams before Boston starts falling or before Tampa start falling. So we could end up in a division where, apart from the Canadiens, all those teams will be good teams, and the Canadiens, for them to be part of that group, you could easily see a situation where every team in the Atlantic Division, maybe 2 years from now, will be playing for more than 500 at the expense of other divisions.
Well, so just because we made that point in our piece, right now the Canadiens are the only team in the division that's below 500.
Yeah.
So it's already here. It's not like this is not something that's far away in the future. This is the situation right now.
Yeah, I know, but it's you need one more team, and that's because seeing every team in the division play for 500, this is something that you don't see. I mean, you see that maybe once a decade somewhere in the league. It's not something that's all that common. But you're right. We're there already. Those teams are good. Not that 500 is amazing, because it clearly involves some loser points. But I guess my point is, the Canadians want to rebuild. They want to be good. They want to find sustainable success. But being good is not going to be enough, because you'll have to find, year after year, find ways to leapfrog yourself past some other good teams and establish yourself as a powerhouse, because you have to be among those top four teams in the division, if not a fifth, if the Metro gets weaker. But this is going to be a heightened challenge, because it's not just, oh, we're rebuilding in order to become good again. It's because the reality of how good their division is, is an extra hurdle for them. So, and to me, I wonder to which extent they're going to pay attention to this and say, well, is it going to change how fast we want to do things, how long we want to certain contracts to last, how late we want to, we're going to wait for a kid like Lane Hutson to turn pro, you know, things that multiple decisions. They say, you know what, there is no rush in trying to pretend that this thing is over, because if we try to rush it, we're still going to come up short compared to all those guys.
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of the reality that the Canadians face. Listen, I think there's definitely a cognizance among the front office that not only their division, but the conference in general is a huge challenge. And there's no point. I mean, you look at the Senators, and Senators are fascinating to me because it's because of this question. When do you decide you're ready to do it? How do you determine that? Mm. How many young pieces do you need in place before you decide, okay, we're going to sign that one free agent, we're going to do this, we're going to make that big trade? Ottawa's done all that. Ottawa signed Claude Giroux in free agency. He's been fantastic for them. They go out and get Jacob Chychrun for very little. Great trade. And you just wonder, and you know, like guys like Shane Pinto, you know, sort of Tim Stützle being a superstar already. You know, I mean, they've had a lot of things work as far as decisions that they've made. They've made some bad decisions, but they're, I think, in my opinion, they're in the minority. Most of their decisions have been good. And even having done all that, having made the right decisions, getting Tkachuk in the draft, being able to trade for DeBrincat, getting Stützle at number three. I mean, it's just like all these, they've had a lot of, I don't want to say fortunate bounces, but bounces that they've earned with their decisions, but they've worked out. And even with all that, they might not have timed it right. You know, like it's, the timing might be off. Like their bar is so high to get into a top three spot. Like they need Tampa and Boston to drop quicker than they're probably going to drop. That's their reality. So the Canadians need to be mindful of that, I think, and really go about building it slowly, draft after draft. And smart trade after smart trade, and really, but they're in definitely in no rush, because both Ottawa and Detroit have done some really good things, some really smart things, and I find both of them are hitting their kind of competitive window at the worst possible time. And so the Canadians, I agree, they need to be mindful of when's the right time to hit the gas on this thing, and it's definitely not now. That's for sure.
Yeah, but at the same time, you cannot time yourself based on what other teams are doing all the time, because otherwise there's always going to be good teams. When some are going down, some are going up. You know, the Devils now are a very, very good team. They were not a playoff team last year. So there's always going to be teams to fill any sort of void that you could see. So it's just, you have to manage so that you're going to be the team filling the void or forcing somebody else out. But it's I'm happy that you mentioned the example of signing free agents, because the Montreal Canadiens will have money to play with next summer with all the contracts they'll be able to shed. But even then, and I know that there's going to be pressure from the fan base, from the media, to go out there and sign a player that's going to make them better. But it's probably not the right course of action. If adding one guy, one impact player through free agency, and God forbid I don't like free agency because those guys are already too old. But anyway, if one player would pretty much secure them of a playoff spot, it's a different story. But at the place where they are now, it probably would be a waste of money, waste of resources. And they might be better off saying, you know what, we're going to hold on to that money. We're going to squeeze Carey Price under the cap without even going to LTIR and bite the bullet for one more year and then reconsider the year after and maybe spend more that year. But it's just that if you want to be in a rush to get things done right away, man, it's the competition so stiff. So stiff.
Yeah, I agree with you that you can't determine what you're doing with your team based on when other teams will be bad. That would be ridiculous, and you're right to point that out. But it's also worth considering, do we have a realistic chance in this window? And it's like with the Senators, they've kind of set up a situation where the next two seasons after this one, something's got to give. You know, like Claude Giroux, that's the length of his contract. God knows if he'll actually be effective for the length of his contract, but that's also the length of Chychrun's contract, at the end of which, if he continues trending the way he's trended, he will be worth far more than $4.6 million. So like you kind of see, and then if it doesn't work in that window, you're not starting over completely, because they've been good about signing Tkachuk long-term. They signed Batherson for a long-term deal.
Norris,
Stützle, they're all signed. Artem Zub's even signed for a long till 2027. Jake Sanderson, they're probably going to sign long term at the end of next year. So they have, but it's my point being that you don't want those years where everything line up, where you have a Claude Giroux with one more year left on his deal, so probably his last, maybe his last like effective season, which would be next year. You have Chychrun at that number. You have Sanderson on an entry on the last year of the entry level deal next year. All these little components that add up and allow you to load up your one big competitive year. Like to me, for Ottawa, I think it's next year. Like they have to try and break through. Assuming they can bring DeBrincat back, that's they have to do that. It's not the end of their competitive window, but it's definitely. It's open. Like, and so the thing about a window is that unless you're the Tampa Bay Lightning, usually a window opens and then it closes pretty fast. So you have to make it count when you're in it, you know? So that's kind of the thing. So, but you're right. The Canadiens can't just look at the other teams and just throw their hands up and be like, well, we're gonna have to wait our turn. No, that's not the way to go about it either. It's just that there's a lot of thought that needs to go into it. And the Canadiens are nowhere near their competitive window opening is, I guess, the overarching point here.
Okay, we've got a second voicemail that we wanted to play and discuss. Just a friendly reminder, if you want to leave us a message, if you want to ask us a question, you can do so by calling our voicemail. The number is 646-847-9404.
Yes! Yes! You did it!
Thank you.
Yes.
I can't believe it. All right. Let's listen to it.
Just wondering, is there a trade that would make sense where Josh Anderson would go to the Jets and we'd get Pierre-Luc Dubois back? Whatever other pieces might have to happen in there. Looking forward to your thoughts.
All right. Thank you for the question, James. Yes, listen, that is kind of the obvious inference, I guess, to make from Josh Anderson's situation. My one thing, and because Josh Anderson's contract, as opposed to many other teams, would be a real selling point to the Winnipeg Jets. You know, the fact that he's under contract, so they'll have him for the next 3 years, is, while some teams would look at that as a burden at that number, sorry, for the next 4 years, while some people would look at that as a burden at $5.5 million, I think the Jets would look at that as a plus. And so Josh Anderson's got an 8-team no trade list. I don't know this for a fact. I'd be willing to bet to some degree that maybe Winnipeg's on it. I don't know. It's the unfortunate reality for the Winnipeg Jets is that they're on a lot of Pete Laird's no trade lists. That's just that's just a fact. But definitely, if the Canadiens are going to make a hard push to trade for Pierre-Luc Dubois as opposed to waiting for him to hit unrestricted free agency, it seems natural that Josh Anderson would be at the center of that, because he would be an attractive piece to the Jets, unless the Jets decide that they have to go in a new direction and rebuild. Unless the Jets decide that this was it, this is what we're watching right now, is their chance, because Connor Hellebuck's going to be up. You know, Blake Wheeler's not getting any younger. Like, they have some good young pieces, but they have some real questions on the horizon that will need answering. You know, when Connor Hellebuck hits unrestricted free agency next summer, 2024, what does that contract look like? And if it looks like something in the $9 million range, is that something you really want to do? You want to sign a 30-year-old goalie at $9 million a year? I don't know. They have a lot of questions they need to ask. So it makes sense. Josh Anderson, I think, would help the Jets. But Mark Scheifele's also up after next season. Like, it's just a time. Blake Wheeler's up after next season. Like, they're at a really weird, wonky time. Nikolaj Ehlers is 2 years away from being a UFA. Like, it's a tough time for them. And I don't know how they're going to approach this whole thing. They might look at this season and be like, okay, we're going to make our run. And then this is going to be the beginning of a retool of some sort. And in which case, maybe prospects would be more attractive to the Jets than someone like Josh Anderson.
Well, to me, the thing is, it's unclear to me where the leverage is exactly. Who's got the upper hand in the potential negotiations? Because the Jets have the interesting player that they, at some point, I'm sure that they'll give it and they'll revisit it in the summer and say, have you changed your mind? You know, we're probably more competitive than you thought we'd be a year ago. So would you be open now to stay and sign long-term in Winnipeg? Maybe that Pierre-Luc Dubois has had a change of mind. That's possible. But if it remains status quo in that sense, they're going to be in a position where they'll know that they have to move him. And I don't know. And if we assume that the Montreal Canadiens is a preferred destination for Dubois, who's really has the convincing argument? Because they might say, you know what, you want the player, well, be ready to pay a premium for him. Or the Canadiens could say, well, if the ask is too much, we'll just wait and sign him in free agency. But if I'm the Jets, for sure I'm looking at long-term stability. And you mentioned Josh Anderson's contract, and that's definitely part of that logic. But he's a winger, and they'll need a centerman. They'll want talent. They'll probably don't want to add salary based on, you know, that the total salary that they would get. I don't think that they would accept something that would cost them more than what they would give Dubois on his next contract. And as you mentioned, they would probably want to get someone to add to their pipeline and make sure that they get younger. They got tons of defensemen, but you know, they need more Cole Perfettis. They need more players like that too. You know, they need good young talent. So I think that where the leverage is between the Canadiens and the Jets, that's really where you could determine what sort of of players could be added to a deal like that. So it's hard for me to really say, oh, who could be a part of that deal, because who's got really the upper hand in those discussions or hypothetical discussions? It's unclear. But you know, the Canadians could say, well, you know, you want a centerman, we'll give you Christian Dvorak. You want a young player, we'll give you Joshua Roy. You'll need someone like that. And if not, if it's too much, if it's too, the Canadians say, or even 1 year of Joel Edmondson, they're packed on the right side, but they would probably be happy to have a steady left-handed defenseman too, a guy who could, you know, help them, with their younger blue line. Who knows? But it's a difficult. Reading the tea leaves right now is a bit difficult.
Yeah, and I would just add to that I think the dynamic for the Canadians has changed as well. Like, they didn't know what they had in Kirby Doc. I think they have a pretty good idea now. And so if you have Nick Suzuki and Kirby Doc and Pierre-Luc Dubois, now Dubois played on the wing when he was in junior, frankly, he was drafted as a winger. We already saw this season that Doc could play on the wing. It's not as if it would be the end of the world, but that has changed as well. I do think that the Canadians should not take it for granted that Pierre-Luc Dubois' preferred destination is the Canadians. It is. He's made that clear. But things change. You know, like, I mean, things, circumstances change. So there's definite, to my mind, the only reason the Canadians make the trade with the Jets is if they get to talk to Dubois and sign him to a deal before. Mm-hmm. And if they do that, if they're allowed to do that, then they pay the actual price that the Jets would want. Because the players you just mentioned, the Jets would probably be like, yeah, no, I don't think so. You know, it's like, I don't think they're, I mean, listen, Joshua was an interesting prospect, but I think it would take something a little bit more significant to get this deal sealed. Cause the Jets also have the option to kind of trade him as a rental of sorts, you know, let's trade him. Listen, he has arb rights, RFA, he'll probably sign for a year. Give us like an extended rental price to get one season of Pierre-Luc Dubois and then see what happens. And there's probably some teams that would do that. And so, so it's not as if the Jets could also just sign him for a year, which they haven't done in the past. I mean, they were in the exact same situation with Jacob Trouba, and they played it the exact same way. Trouba played one more year, and then once he was up for arbitration and was a year away from UFA, they traded him to the Rangers and got a pretty good return. And Jacob Trouba, much like Pierre-Luc Dubois, made it clear that he wanted to play for the Rangers because his wife has a career in medicine in New York. There were all sorts of personal reasons why Jacob Trouba wanted to play for the Rangers. And so it was a very similar circumstance. And the Jets made out okay. You know, they got what'd they get in that deal? Neil Pionk, who's a pretty important part of their blue line right now. Sorry.
I think it was there was a depth forward in that trade too, but I mean it was really not it was mainly a Pionk. There was a first round pick.
There was a first round pick that turned into
Ville. Yeah, they drafted Ville alone Ainola with it.
Yeah, so
yeah.
So that's a pretty significant return. You know, they got a top 4D, legit top 4D, and a first round pick, which wound up being 20th overall. For a guy who was unsigned. So you know, does Neil Pionk equal Josh Anderson? Maybe. Does the Panthers' first round pick equal the 20th overall pick from that year? It's probably better than that. Could that get it done? Maybe. I don't know. It's possible, though. It's definitely possible. Again, assuming Josh Anderson does not have Winnipeg on his no trade list, which I think it's a big assumption to make right now.
But, I mean, if the Canadians were to decide to say, oh, we're going to wait and sign him in free agency, and Dubois is dealt somewhere else, you better not fall in love with that new team that he goes to as a rental.
That's my point exactly. Things change.
Yeah.
Things change. That's why the Canadians have, if everyone, anyone who thinks the Canadians could just sit back and wait for Pierre-Luc Dubois to deliver himself to Montreal, things change, man. And it could be, I mean, who would have expected the Jets to be as competitive as they are this year? Who knows? Maybe things have already changed. Maybe Dubois sees a future in Winnipeg. Things change. So, yeah, Canadians.
But you mentioned, I think that from Montreal's perspective, Kirby Dachs has changed things a lot. And as it stands, if you have everybody healthy, well, honestly, you could do worse as an NHL team than having a center line made of Suzuki, Doc, Dvorak, and Evans.
Yeah.
You don't have a top end first line center, but it's a strong middle because you got depth in it and you're competent on all four lines. So
listen, the question's valid. It's definitely there. But the other thing I would just add in closing here is, the Canadians really like Josh Anderson. It's not that they won't trade him. It's just that they're not dying to trade him. I think that's, you know, the impression with all this. Listen, I've been guilty of it. A lot of the stuff that I wrote, a lot of stuff that everyone's written about Josh Anderson and his status here would lead someone to believe that it's because the Canadians don't like him as a player. That couldn't be further from the truth. The fact that he hasn't been traded yet shows to the extent to which they do like him as a player. And so it's the trade's going to have to be right. Listen, if Josh Anderson got a Pierre-Luc Dubois deal done, I'm sure the Canadians would do it in a heartbeat. But just throwing that out there, that's the other factor here. So that the Canadians are not looking to just throw Josh Anderson to the curb.
And on that note, Arpin, we're going to get ready for tonight's game. So everybody, thank you so much for listening to the Athletic Support this week. We'll be back on Friday. In the meantime, if you have not subscribed to The Athletic yet, well, you can do so by going to theathletic.com/athletic support, and that will give you a discount on the first year of your subscription. So, and don't hesitate if you catch us on Apple Podcasts to leave a 5-star rating, leave maybe a comment or whatnot, and enjoy the rest of the season, enjoy your week, and enjoy each other. It's very important. Bye-bye, everybody.